Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.
Well, we are so blessed to have this man with us today. I met him probably 3 or 4 years ago. He has spoken to several of my groups, and he is such an extraordinary man on this planet doing amazing work in terms of changing people's lives. And, you know, master's and PhD in psychology and 8 books under his belt. And I would say absolutely the last book that I love and adore, Life from the Top of the Mind, was immensely helpful in me navigating my journey in the midst of my son's addiction. And so it is on our book list. And so you get to meet Bill Crawford today, and I am thrilled to have him with us. And we're going to have a very, I think, powerful conversation around grieving the shattered dream. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to you, Bill.
Thank you, KL. By the way, I've loved working with you and your groups in that area in Eugene. Are you still in Eugene?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Great country, wonderful people there. So every time you've had me there has been a real pleasure. Thank you for that opportunity. And
absolutely.
The whole thing around grieving, especially as I started doing it with Vistage, was basically, I think, because you called Vistage and went, hey, mm-hmm. do we have anybody that does grieving stuff? And mm-hmm. so I've mm-hmm. done now 2 or 3 or 4 of these, and they're very powerful and a lot of fun. Seems to be really meaningful.
Absolutely. I mean, our culture does such a poor job of this. The fact that you and I had a conversation around grieving, and then in that conversation, found out that you're an expert in this arena, I'm like, okay, you need to be talking about that within the Vistage community too. So anyway, I'm thrilled that that's happened, and I'm thrilled that you're able to bring that to our community today.
Thanks. The way you become an expert at anything mm-hmm. is you get thrown into the fire, right?
So mm-hmm. yes.
When I was around 21, I was an only child, and my mom and dad died of cancer within around 6 months of each other when I was around 21. And so I was from East Texas. I didn't know anything about emotion. I didn't know anything about grieving. And being a guy, it just totally freaked me out. I just shut down, put all the walls up mm-hmm. and decided I'm not going to feel anything negative for the rest of my life. And unfortunately, I stayed in that kind of shut down mode for about mm-hmm. 10 years because mm-hmm. I was so afraid of touching that pain, afraid of right. getting overwhelmed by it. Yeah. Until I got into a counseling program at the University of Houston, where they're smart enough to make you deal with your own stuff before they let you loose on the public.
Yeah, so, smart.
Exactly. So we were sitting around talking about our life. And I said, yeah, well, you know, my mom and dad died of cancer when I was around 21. But, you know, I'm okay. They went, whoa, 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 what? And I went, yeah, but you know, stuff happens. You just got to move on. You got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. They went, oh, no. I said, Bill, if you're going to help people deal with this stuff, you can't blow it off like that. And I knew they were right. Mm-hmm. But I was so afraid of touching that pain.
Right.
Took me about 6 months to get finally courageous enough to touch that mm-hmm. pain. And when you haven't cried over losing your parents in 10 years, yeah. when you start crying, you can't stop.
Yeah.
But for the first time in my life, it felt really, really good to feel really, really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was the first time I touched the love I had for my parents in 10 years. Because you mm-hmm. can't touch love, it's too close to the pain.
Mm-hmm.
So now when I'm helping people deal with grief, I call the tears liquid love.
Mm-hmm.
It is a behavioral manifestation of how much we care.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, as you're right, our culture sees it as breaking down, falling to pieces, losing it, becoming mm-hmm. a basket case, very pejorative terms.
Mm-hmm.
And I say our Western culture, some of the Eastern cultures and the Mediterranean cultures, they just dive right into it and are mm-hmm. much more open to that. But we see it that way. So it's become a specialty of mine because I experienced it and went through some transformation. Mm-hmm. And in that transformation, I stumbled across a gentleman by the name of Ken Moses, psychologist mm-hmm. up in Chicago, who's come up with the concept of grieving the shattered dream. Mm-hmm. And he works with parents who've lost a child. So you can imagine the shattered dream that goes with there. And it's a really great concept because he says, which really resonates with me, often the intensity of the grief isn't just about what we've lost. It's about what we'll never be as a result of that. And since we all have dreams about our kids and relationships and jobs and pets and life, and they're always perfect, then when they get shattered, mm-hmm. that makes that grief more intense. Mm-hmm. So in trying to help people come to some sort of understanding of the process, number one, the whole concept of grieving a shattered dream seems to resonate with people. And then the idea of looking at it as a process that is designed to help us move from kind of the past to the future, from inaction to action, from shattered dreams to more purposeful dreams, but mm-hmm. it's supposed to be helpful. Mm-hmm. So I think the challenge is to look at all the ways we find ourselves feeling grief. You know, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross goes into the five stages of, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And that was good when it came out because it normalized the process.
Right.
But if anybody's ever done any grieving, you don't go from this stage to this stage and then wind up in acceptance. Well, that was good. You know, it's go one and you go back to the other and then you repeat it and you come. So Ken Moses, he took the five stages of grief and came up with what he calls seven feeling states of grieving. Hmm. And he talked about how each of them serve a purpose. Mm-hmm. So denial and shock is designed to kind of have us be able to step back enough so we're not totally overwhelmed by it.
Right.
And it's designed to kind of give us a moment to marshal external and internal resources so mm-hmm. that we can kind of step into the process. Mm-hmm. But then he talks about sadness and tears as a natural, normal, healthy mm-hmm. process. And I think that's the challenge that we have to recognize is, you know, people talk about grief being a wave of emotion. Mm-hmm. You know, driving down the road, all of a sudden a wave of emotion washes over me. Mm-hmm. If we'll treat it like a wave, because if we're in the ocean and here comes a wave, if we dive into the wave, mm-hmm. we come out on the other side. Mm-hmm. So, but if we fight the wave, the mm-hmm. wave will take us and throw us on the floor of the ocean and roll us around. So one of the things I encourage people to do is after they kind of recognize the grieving, the shattered dream component mm-hmm. is to be able to discern mm-hmm. what aspects of grieving are helpful that I want to kind of feed, and what aspects of grieving do I want to maybe minimize so that because they're not very helpful.
Yeah.
And I kind of move them into a process of figuring that out.
Yeah. Well, I love that you touched on courage and that love, deep love, is inherently present with grief. Mm-hmm. And you can't have one without the other.
Right.
And the transformation that takes place. Now, I believe both of us are talking about a transformation in terms of an higher evolution for ourselves through the process of grief. And so, yes, so this is a very powerful conversation. I was talking about this morning with Patty, and I said, you know, the day that Sam was arrested and I stood on the sidewalk and watched that whole thing take place in front of me, I literally was very aware. Every dream I had for him mm-hmm. shattered on that road right then and there and that sidewalk. And so to be touching this through your lens, you know, that I completely admire and believe in your words, and also know for our audience that your dad was a recovering alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And so Bill just doesn't come to this through the looking glass, so to speak, of his own grief, but he comes through it through also AA.
Yeah. I was an AA baby. My mom and dad were married 25 years before I was born, and I was their only child. Mm-hmm. So my dad got sober 3 years before I was born. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of born into an AA family. You know, they took me to meetings and I just kind of played around while they'd talk to people and mm-hmm. people would come over to the house and spill their guts. So that whole transformational culture was mm-hmm. really a big part of my growing up. Of course, you don't know it when you're growing up. You just think that's the way it's supposed to be. And everybody's that way.
Right.
And it has served me well after that. There's some grieving you got to do when you're kind of coming, recognizing, you know, have the courage to kind of look at how you found yourself dealing with your life.
Yes.
Frankly, you know, that one of the things I love about grieving is that there's only one person on the planet that we will never leave and will never leave us. Mm-hmm. And that's us. Mm-hmm. So the loss is such a huge part of life, but we don't get any kind of training or any good modeling about how to deal with it.
Right.
And so that's why I love the idea of, you know, my life from the top of the mind model talks about coming from what I call the discerning brain, the clear, confident, creative brain versus this old reactive brain, which is that lower brain. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I help people do is get kind of, there's a model that I have that actually shifts people to the discerning brain so they can look at their experiences of grieving and say, okay, this is helpful. This I want to go through. This is meaningful. This, not so much. You know, it's normal, it's natural, but it's not helpful. So I want to be able to minimize that while I maximize the helpful part.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are so many stories, and particularly right now, we're just in this pandemic of addiction.
Yeah.
And so there's, you know, people dying, and there's people waking up to the fact that their spouse or their child or their aunt or uncle or a friend is, you know, drowning themselves in alcohol or medications. And now what? And the first general reaction is you go into crisis mode and you're in your brainstem. And so if you could, you know, speak to, because this was super powerful for me, was to understand how my brain was working and that I was at choice. And that choice, those choices give us agency again. When we are in the washing machine of desperation and hopelessness and all that swirls around, learning this for the first time, or even over months and years, there are people who just stay in that washing machine, not knowing they have a choice. Right.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So basically, I talk about three parts of the brain. You know, the brain's very complicated, but rather than get into all the parts of the brain, you know, that do everything, I want to get three parts. Mm-hmm. What I call the top of the mind's the neocortex. The lower brain down the back of the neck is called the brainstem. That's where our fight or flight responses are kind of triggered. Mm-hmm. And the middle brain is called the limbic system. And it's that middle brain that's the really interesting brain, because that brain acts as a gatekeeper. Or in today's terminology, it acts as a scanner, a processor, and a router.
So great way to look at it.
Yeah. It scans incoming data, and the data could be I've lost someone close to me, it could be my son or lover or husband or wife is addicted, whatever it is, but it's some sort of data. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, this middle brain isn't very smart, and it's working with old software. Mm-hmm. So it has a tendency to interpret almost anything negative as dangerous and throws us into the part of the brain, the lower brain, that's designed to deal with danger. Because the way it's kept us alive as a species over evolution as of us as of a species has been to keep us worried and anxious and on guard and, you know, alert by using anxiety and fear and worry to keep us safe. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, it's still in this worry keeps us safe. Anxiety keeps us safe. Like if you're not anxious, you're in trouble because something's going to sneak up on you. Mm-hmm. So it has a tendency to misinterpret negative situations as dangerous, throws us into the part of the brain that's designed to deal with danger. This is where we get angry, stressed, frustrated, annoyed, resentful, depressed, anxious, all those emotions that are totally understandable, but they're all lower brain stuff. Mm-hmm. Because we can't deal with life from those perspectives, when we try to deal with life from this lower brain and we're not very effective, we get re-triggered. And so the middle brain goes, whoa, well, now you're not even very effective, but you're so anxious. And it throws us back into the lower brain and we get trapped in this cycle of reaction and misinterpretation. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people don't know that's going on. They think the situation itself is making me feel bad and I've got to change the situation before I can change how I feel.
Exactly.
But a lot of times that's just not an option. You know, someone has died or someone is addicted. There's a reality out there that we can't do anything about. Mm-hmm. And we've got to be able to kind of make sure we're coming from the most effective, clear, confident, creative, compassionate part of who we are in order to be able to help anybody in our family or help ourselves or deal with the situation effectively.
Yeah, which was so powerful for me to learn. And so now take that learning and apply it to the grieving process.
I will. By the way, something just popped into my head that I want to kind of congratulate you and your group for turning me on to. I remember doing my presentation to your group and someone said, Bill, have you read The Body Keeps the Score?
Aha.
And I went, no. And they go, oh my God, you're going to love that. So of course I got it. And
great.
I have underlined every page, you know, mm-hmm. it's just like an amazing book. So mm-hmm. anybody who's ever dealt with any kind of trauma or knows anybody who's ever dealt with any kind of trauma, it's a wonderful book. It's become the Bible, I think, about how to help people deal with trauma, because it talks about how trauma rewires the brain, because
right.
this middle brain goes, trauma, well, we don't want that to happen again. So it keeps bringing it up again and again, mm-hmm. thinking it's keeping us safe when the reality is it's just re-traumatizing us.
Right.
So for those of anybody out there that wants to have an understanding of how trauma affects the brain and some wonderful ways of dealing with it, because mm-hmm. it fits very nicely into, you know, the life from the top of the mind system, then I would really highly recommend that book.
Great for bringing that up. That's a brilliant book.
Now, I forgot the question you asked me.
Oh, love you. Now that we've gone through some how the brain works, mm-hmm. take that knowledge and apply it to grieving the shattered dream.
Okay, great. So really what we've got to be able to do is, number one, understand that our guilt, our anxiety, our anger, our resentment, our fear, our worry, our depression, our tears, all mm-hmm. of that is just totally normal. This is mm-hmm. not our failure to cope. This is not what's wrong with us. It's totally normal.
Right.
And some of it's going to be helpful and some of it isn't.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to be able to dive into that wave in a way that's helpful and minimize that fear, guilt, shame, anxiety, depression, anger stuff, because, well, the anger sometimes can be helpful because it can kind of move us into action. But mm-hmm. the rest of the stuff is generally not very helpful. We start either beating ourselves up or, mm-hmm. you know, blaming God or whatever it is, where you just really get into this kind of reaction.
Well, and a lot of people, you know, looking at some of the Facebook groups that are out there, people are losing their homes. They're devastating themselves financially. Yeah. They're in constant, like they're following their kids around, or they're, you know, they're doing all these crazy things
yeah.
to control the situation
yeah.
to the point of, you know, losing their health,
yeah.
losing their stability, and losing their lives, actually, really. You know,
yeah.
so yes, it gets quite dire for people who do not understand how this works. And so what's the pathway to maximizing the things in grief that are really good to lean into mm-hmm. and minimizing the things that we really do need to let go of?
So it's basically a five-step process, and it starts with making sure this upper 80% of the brain is in charge. So it's, how do I get the top of the mind to regain control from the lower brain?
Mm-hmm.
Well, since the lower brain controls breathing, then breathing can be a great way of beginning the process of coming from the top of the mind. So mm-hmm. whether it's box breathing, 4-4, or just using the 4-4-4 method, or inhaling and saying something on the exhale, whatever it is, if mm-hmm. you'll breathe purposefully and slowly mm-hmm. and actually count while you're doing it, since there's mm-hmm. only one part of the brain that can count, it mm-hmm. begins to have the upper brain kind of regain control from the lower brain. It's a great place to start.
I just want to give an explanation point on the counting part.
Yes.
Because we hear so much about how breath work, you know, really helps us shift and so on and so forth. But when I heard you say that, I was like, brilliant. And I talk about that all the time, is our brain stems do not count.
Nope.
And so if we're counting, we're up here.
That's right.
And that is a really quick way to make that shift. So I thank you so much for that. And I wanted to put an exclamation point on that. So make sure people hear that today.
Yeah. So my method is, I mean, it's not my method. It's a method called the 4-4-4 method. You basically inhale for a count of four, hold it for a count of four, exhale for a count of four. So you're mm-hmm. counting while you're doing it. I like to tick something off of my fingers because that requires this part of the brain to be in charge. So my mm-hmm. goal, whenever I'm wanting to be in the discerning brain, into the mm-hmm. clear, confident, creative, compassionate part of who I am, mm-hmm. so I can make a conscious, purposeful decision about what I feed and what I change, is the breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second step in the model is to relax into the feeling. So whatever it is, just mm-hmm. relax into it. If it's anger, relax into it. That way we're not fighting it anymore.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
If it's anxiety, mm-hmm. if it's worry, whatever it is, don't fight it. Just relax into it. And if it's tears and sadness, again, relax into it. That can be the liquid love part. You know, it can mm-hmm. be something that says something about us. So we breathe, we relax, and then we ask two questions. One is, how I'm feeling and reacting right now, is that making the statement I want to make about who I am?
So for example, say that again, Bill. Say that again. That's
yeah.
just such a great question.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So is how I'm feeling right now, how I'm reacting, is that how I want to define myself? Is that the statement I want to make about who I am? Mm-hmm. So if I lose something or someone meaningful and I find myself having tears and sadness about that, that's exactly how I want to feel. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be someone that goes, yeah, yeah, who cares next? You know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I want to feel that sadness. So now the sadness and the tears, the liquid love, becomes mm-hmm. a statement of who I am that I can be proud of. So the denial gives me an opportunity to step back and not deal with stuff. So that's also a really helpful stage or phase if you need it. Mm-hmm. The sadness is liquid love. It's something to be proud of. That word of proud of is something that most people don't think about when they're grieving. You know, mm-hmm. grieving, proud of. That's what I felt when I finally felt sad enough about my family, my dad and mom to cry about it. It's just like, yeah. Okay, Bill, finally, you're kind of feeling these feelings. And that's where I felt I connected with the love that I had for them. So is this the statement I want to make about who I am? Because mm-hmm. what? Worry, anxiety, fear, resentment, guilt, shame? Probably not. Mm-hmm. So it gives us a way of discerning between the helpful and the non-helpful. Mm-hmm. And the second one is, okay, would I teach or recommend this way of being to my child, my children, or someone I love?
Okay, say it again.
Yes. So how is I myself feeling? All right, I relax into it. Is it making the statement I want to make about who I am? Would I teach or recommend this way of being to my child, my children, mm-hmm. or someone I love? So if my kids were dealing with a loss of something, maybe a loss of relationship or loved one or whatever, and mm-hmm. they came to me and said, boy, I just feel like crying, I'd go, hey, come here. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend that. Or if they mm-hmm. said, you know, I just can't deal with it right now. I just need to almost pretend it doesn't happen. I go, that's a very helpful part of grieving, to kind of step back far enough to where you're not overwhelmed by it. So stay, you know, do that. Mm-hmm. So those two I would feed, because number one, it makes the statement I want to make about who I am. And it's what mm-hmm. I would recommend to someone I love. But again, mm-hmm. guilt, shame, anxiety, mm-hmm. worry, fear, even mm-hmm. anger to some degree. The mm-hmm. only way anger is helpful is when it moves us from depression to action, because anger is a more powerful mm-hmm. emotion mm-hmm. than depression. Mm-hmm. So if you're choosing between anger and depression, at least initially, anger is a better choice mm-hmm. because it's got some energy and movement to it.
Yeah.
But you don't want to stay there very long. You just want to use it to move from that depression, anxiety component into that.
Yeah. So you're actually using the emotion as a catalyst for action.
That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, that's how anger serves the process. Mm-hmm. As long as you don't just stay there and just stay mm-hmm. angry for the entire time, because it's mm-hmm. designed to move us from action to inaction. I mean, from inaction to action, from mm-hmm. the past to the future. Yeah.
Right.
So there's breathing, there's relaxing, there's asking these questions. Mm-hmm. Now we say, okay, I know that sadness and tears and even denial and maybe anger sometimes is okay. This is how I want to define myself. Mm-hmm. So what does that look like? So you want to imagine being the way you want to be. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's because the brain does not know the difference between a real and an imagined event. Mm-hmm. So when you imagine feeling sad, the brain and the body will feel sad. Mm-hmm. When you imagine feeling angry, the brain and the body will feel angry. Mm-hmm. So what we want to do is to make sure that we are actually imagining the way we want to be, because just deciding how I want to be is a decision, but imagining that actually has the brain and the body connecting in a way where you are chemically changing the brain and the body. Mm-hmm. When we get stuck in the lower brain, we're triggering adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol. Those are mm-hmm. the fight or flight chemicals. Mm-hmm. When we're in the upper brain, we're triggering serotonin and endorphins. Chemicals that help us feel better and think clear. And feel mm-hmm. better doesn't mean feel good necessarily. You just mean feel better, like mm-hmm. feel sad or feel mm-hmm. the way we want to feel.
Go. Yeah. And that's such a great distinction too, that our brain doesn't know if we're actually in it or not.
That's right.
And so that is super powerful also, is in those moments. I know personally, you know, when I've gone to worry, I would take my little brain and I'd go backpacking to spots that I've been that are beautiful and calming and center me back up.
Yes. Centered. That's really good. Mm-hmm. You want to think of yourself as centered, you know?
Yes.
You're kind mm-hmm. of an Aikido master, and you're centered and you're focused. Mm-hmm. And here comes life, throws you a punch, and you go, well, goodness gracious. And mm-hmm. you kind of take it and you go with it. So that mm-hmm. that centered is great. Mm-hmm. Plus, the idea of being able to imagine how we want to be and have the body change chemically as a result of that mm-hmm. puts us in a very influential place in terms of our mind and body. There is a nerve that connects the mind to the body. It's called the vagus nerve. Mm-hmm. And the vagus nerve goes all the way through the body. The vagus in Latin, I think, means wandering. So it's kind of goes to our heart and our lungs and our muscles and our mm-hmm. gut and everything.
Yeah.
So when the brain tells the vagus nerve that we're in danger, it goes into the sympathetic nervous reaction, system reaction, which is fight or flight. Mm-hmm. When the brain tells the vagus nerve to relax, it goes into the parasympathetic reaction, which is that calming down and more purposeful way of being. Mm-hmm. So it's that using the imaging of here is how I want to be, and here's what that looks like and feels like, mm-hmm. so that I am holding an image of how I want to be. Every once in a while, I'll be just doing something and some terrible image of someone yeah. I love will come into my mind just mm-hmm. from everywhere, like some car wreck or something. Mm-hmm. And I literally go, I just literally shake my head and dismiss it. And mm-hmm. then I go on what I'm doing, but I don't worry about it mm-hmm. and I don't feed it because mm-hmm. I know that if I do that, see, it's my middle brain thinking, okay, well, Bill, you're just not worried enough here. You know, you need to be worried about something.
Right, right. And
that's not
well,
the same.
And that's such a great thing too, Bill, because we all have these random thoughts that just show up. And then most people tend to give them energy. And it's like, oh my God, stop, time out. It's just a random thought. Or it's something you've watched on TV or a movie or all that other crap that's out there. And so what we feed ourselves, super, super important. And I know that's been part of my coping mechanism through this whole thing is, I don't watch the news anymore. I see headlines. I rely on people to tell me stuff that's really important. I don't watch Murder and Mayhem. I don't watch anything that takes me out of who I intend to be, which is really, truly an expression of calm mm-hmm. and centeredness and love. And that's mm-hmm. who I want to be in the world.
Yeah, we got to be careful because media and politics have determined and mm-hmm. discovered mm-hmm. that if they can trigger our middle brain, they've mm-hmm. got us. Mm-hmm. So either they've got us to vote a certain way or they've got us to buy certain products. Mm-hmm. But that's their goal, is to sell certain products and get us to vote. It's generally not malicious for the most part. They're not. Some of them can be weird.
Most of them
are just wanting to think, well, if I can get you to do it, well, it's going to be good for you, you know, so uh-huh. I'm going to do it any way I can. But there are algorithms and Facebook and all the social media mm-hmm. that are designed to trigger the middle brain. And certainly mm-hmm. you've seen all the fear and stuff going on in politics. But even, in the media, there's a phrase. It's not so much there anymore, but it used to be. It's called "If it bleeds, it leads."
Correct.
That is designed to capture your middle brain so that you'll stay glued, so that when they go mm-hmm. to commercial, they can sell you some. So we want to make sure we're not giving that media the power to control us and throw us into that mm-hmm. lower brain, and being very purposeful about what we watch and what we consume, what mm-hmm. we feed the brain. What would I recommend to someone I love?
Right.
It'd be a great way of looking at all of that.
Right. And I think that for me, I have framed this in that this has been one of the great gifts out of this experience with Sam is, I'm on a journey too, and he's on a journey. And out of his journey, I have been catalyzed to do these kinds of things and to understand more about how my brain works and how all these things work so that I can take my power back and be much more intentional and focused about how I want to act, how I want to be in the world, and all that goes with that. And particularly right now, another reason why I think this conversation is really paramount is that we're in such a disruptive time. I mean, everything is up mm-hmm. and there's more anger and there's more accidents and there's more killings and there's more all the things. And I attribute that to people need to skill up and elevate in terms of skills and understanding and spirituality and all of the things. So
basically it's a five-step model. You breathe in order to have the top of the mind kind of regain control. You relax into the emotion, whatever it is, that way you're not fighting it. You ask the question, is this the statement I want to make about who I am? Would I teach or recommend it to someone I love? The answer is no. Then you shift to, okay, then what do I want to feed? What do I want to kind of validate? Imagine mm-hmm. being that way. And then you notice the change, because mm-hmm. who am I at the end of the model?
Right.
Plus
right.
the N, and notice, helps me spell brain, B-R-A-I-N. So I like my models to spell
brilliant.
It makes it easy to remember. But yeah. It's all about understanding how the brain works and being able mm-hmm. to influence how the brain works around a subject, around grieving, around dealing mm-hmm. with loss and mm-hmm. things like that. We just don't get any training around and don't get any modeling around.
Right. And can you speak to the kind of the creation and cementing of this habit? Because that's another overriding of our brain is yep. rewiring our neural pathways for this type of habit.
Yes. So when I'm doing my presentations, we do the brain model. And I say, okay, has anybody ever gotten an email and been triggered? Maybe this morning. Anybody ever gotten a text message and been triggered? Anybody ever been in traffic and been triggered? Anybody ever seen anything on social media or cable news and been triggered? A voicemail and been triggered? Everybody goes, yes, 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 yes. So there's so many situations in our life that we get triggered that we could start practicing this particular model.
Mm-hmm.
And if we'll start practicing it, mm-hmm. it actually begins to mm-hmm. rewire the brain. So it starts retraining mm-hmm. the middle brain to say, wait a minute, I can keep us safe by accessing this clear, confident, creative part of who I am versus throwing us into the all reactive brain. Because mm-hmm. when we are practicing, we really are creating and reinforcing new neural pathways going from mm-hmm. the middle brain to the upper brain.
Mm-hmm.
So what I encourage people to do is to use the brain model anytime they get triggered.
Mm-hmm.
Then what I encourage them to do is, you know, there's a way of actually going into mm-hmm. life already in the top of the mind, so mm-hmm. you don't get triggered as much in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this way, you don't have to wait until you're triggered to practice this. So I talk mm-hmm. about waking up in the morning, mm-hmm. and before you get out of bed, before you look at your phone, before you do anything, you say, okay, what's my highest purpose this morning? Mm-hmm. When I say highest purpose, I mean, what are the qualities or characteristics I want to bring to the mm-hmm. morning? Just the morning. I know some of the people I'm going to be dealing with, some of the situations I'm going to be in. Who do I want to be? How do I want to be? I choose two or three qualities or characteristics. Imagine going into the morning that way. And then I use the morning to practice defining who I am.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually going into the morning already clear about the qualities and characteristics I want to be able to bring to life. Doesn't mean mm-hmm. I need to be perfect around it, but I do mm-hmm. want to practice it as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
That puts me in a more proactive versus reactive state of mind.
Right.
Then around lunchtime, I suggest we reboot. So you do mm-hmm. the brain model, you say a prayer, you take a walk around the house, take a walk outside, you do some deep breathing, whatever it is you do to create a moment of clarity and ask mm-hmm. that question, what's my highest purpose this afternoon? Just mm-hmm. the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
I know some of the people I'm going to be dealing with, the situations, who do I want to be? How do I want to be? Choose qualities or characteristics. This isn't necessarily what I want to accomplish. These are the qualities or characteristics right. I want to bring to life.
Mm-hmm.
Go into the afternoon practicing being that way.
Mm-hmm.
Then around lunchtime or the drive home or sometime between the afternoon and the evening, you reboot and say, okay, what's my highest purpose this evening?
Mm-hmm.
Who do I want to be with the most important people in my life? Mm-hmm. You know, so mm-hmm. you don't just go into the evening kind of on autopilot or exhausted from the day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way of going into the morning, into the afternoon and the evening already in the top of the mind. And I encourage people to do that for 21 days in a row.
Mm-hmm.
Because what that will do is that will actually begin to rewire the brain because they say it takes 21 days to change a habit.
Great. Awesome. Yes. Because what I think most people don't understand that it takes intention and practice to create a new habit.
That's right.
And you just don't do it once and then, oh, it's there. It's just like learning how to ride a bicycle. You didn't just ride it the first time out of the box.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. You know, they have something called a backwards bicycle. If you Google it, it's a hoot.
Okay.
And when you turn the handlebars this way, the bicycle goes that way.
Huh.
When you turn the bar this way, in other words, it's opposite. So
yeah.
when you first get on it, because you're used to doing it, you can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you'll practice and practice and they show people practicing and finally yeah. the brain kind of flips.
Yes.
And now I can ride it. But then when right. they try to ride a normal bicycle again, they can't ride it because the brain has changed. So,
yeah.
you know, I always tell people we're always practicing something.
Mm-hmm.
There is no neutral experience. We're either reinforcing mm-hmm. a lower brain or upper brain mm-hmm. perspective. Why don't mm-hmm. we practice the statement we want to make about who we are and what we would teach or recommend to those we love? That
mm-hmm.
puts us in a much more purposeful way of dealing with it, whether it's grief or just, you know, getting in a car wreck or losing mm-hmm. our job or anything that happens that's negative, we're keeping our middle brain from interpreting it as dangerous. Now, if it is dangerous and we need to run from it or fight it, then the middle brain's great. But there are very few of those situations in our life. So it puts us in a more purposeful, powerful state of mind.
Yes. And I do believe that, you know, a large piece of your work, my work, is giving people permission to step into their power.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's a second, you know, my book has three components to it. The first part is called the brain model, and that's how to shift to the top of the mind. The second part actually spells power. So there are another five steps to work with in terms of actually beginning to rewire the brain. And the third part of the book is, okay, now that I know how to get to the top of the mind and stay there, how do I get other people to get to the top of the mind? And that's a different seminar.
Yes. Right? And we'll actually be talking about that in the second part of this series that we're going to do with you. This is, I think, one of the $64 million questions is, how do I talk to my son or daughter who is in dealing with the disease of drug addiction? How do I talk to my spouse who has relapsed after 20 years of not drinking? How do I talk to my parents? All of those things, because I generally think most people are at a complete loss, because what we want to do is tell them to change.
That's right. Step out of it. What are you thinking? Don't you know how bad this is? What are you doing? We're kind of in that lower brain trying to make them feel bad enough to stop the problem. Correct. But unfortunately, what that's doing is driving them deeper into that more resistant brain, which unfortunately is part of the problem in the first place. So we'll get into, there's actually a six-step model we're going to go into about getting people to shift. And it's not only about the things we talked about here, but anytime you want to be influential with someone, the model can be helpful.
Right, exactly. And I just love the fact that we have you.
Thank you.
Yes, because I mean, so many people are not aware of the power of what we can do that takes us out of the desperation and the hopelessness and all that, you know, generally a lot of people are swirling in. And I remember distinctly, this has been several months ago, Sam has now almost 7 months clean and sober. The last relapse was fentanyl. And that was a very desperate time. And because that is just Russian roulette.
Yeah.
And so we hit a point in our journey where Patty just said, I don't have any hope and I'm an eternal optimist. And so I chose to be who I am, which is I held the space for her to hold that belief until she was ready to shift it.
Yeah. That's a protective thing. You know, when people give up hope, it's like, okay, I've been hopeful and I've been disappointed. I've been hopeful and I've been disappointed. I've been hopeful and I can't go through that anymore. So I'm just going to stop being hopeful. Unfortunately, that's kind of a resignation thing. It's understandable. And you let that person feel that because you're not going to tell them that, well, no, you should be hopeful. You know, you're not going to make them hopeful until they were ready to, okay. All right. Okay. Maybe I can have a little hope, you know, kind of move into that just a little bit. But yeah, it's a brain gets real protective in that way. And sometimes it's helpful and necessary because it keeps us from being so disappointed. We just want to make sure that it's defining who we are and something we would recommend to those we love.
Right. And just one last thing before we wrap this up is that the ups and downs of the emotional roller coaster of this journey, I think of all the journeys that I can think of, this is the one that has that highs and lows could be in rapid fire. And, you know, I remember one of the times when Sam had been relapsed and he finally decided that he would go back into rehab again. And, you know, we're like, yay. And then that night he jumps the fence and, you know, goes back out into the darkness again. And we go, oh, crap. And so in those moments, I was like, okay, I'm taking my emotional set back.
Right.
I have absolutely no control over what he's going to do. And so I was rewiring and working what you talked about. And just this notion that, you know, every relapse is a step towards clean. And that was the mantra for me. And although we all know, you know, somebody can pass away from this disease, of course, I held the mantra that every relapse was a step in the direction of clean. And so if you could just touch on, you know, those highs, lows, because I'm trying to hit people kind of where they're struggling in terms of their emotional journey on this.
Yeah.
And that is definitely one of them.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up. Both of you and I are pretty positive people, but we don't want to crumble around. You're just supposed to put a smile on your face and be really positive and just ignore any negative. Blah, blah, blah,
right.
Blah, 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 blah. So that's
right.
not about it.
No.
It's about the fact that we feel bad for those we love because we love them.
Yes.
You know? Because
yes.
we care.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge is it puts us in a position that not only keeps us from being able to help them if we can, but also really not able to help ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can look at those bad feelings and those highs and lows, perfectly normal, mm-hmm. totally normal. This is not our failure to cope. This is not mm-hmm. what's wrong with us.
Mm-hmm.
It's just some of those feelings are helpful that we might want to mm-hmm. kind of feed, and some of them are not. We want to be able to minimize those.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that ability to discern between the two
mm-hmm.
and see our grieving as liquid love, something to be proud of, and be able to, you know, dive into it whenever it comes, when that wave emotion comes up. Here we go. We dive into it, something to feel proud of. And really be very gentle with ourselves in the process.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you want to be a little careful about, full of care, not worried, but full of care, careful,
mm-hmm.
is to be careful about equating love and worry.
Yes.
A lot of people grow up saying, the reason I care mm-hmm. is because I'm in love with you, because I worry because I love you.
Right.
And unfortunately, now we've got love and worry totally tied together.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a phrase I heard that says, sometimes people don't change until it becomes too painful not to.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so when someone's going through that addictive mm-hmm. process, sometimes it just has to get too painful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, what is, you know, they say about the third rehab is the one that really may take, you know, because
mm-hmm.
the first one, just because someone told me to, or I'm supposed to, yeah, I'm in rehab,
mm-hmm.
you know, but as it goes through. So we got to be willing to let people have their pain.
Yes.
Because that might be the flip for them. That might be, okay, this is just too painful. I'm going to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one
mm-hmm.
of the things I love about AA. You know, they don't tell you you're supposed to stop drinking. They say, hey, whenever it becomes too painful and you want some help, you give us a call and we'll be there.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not trying to convince you of anything. You know, we're going to be there for you. And when you're ready to move into that process.
Yeah.
So yeah, roller coaster, real mm-hmm. normal.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people need to feel really, really bad in order to be motivated to change.
Right. And we live in a culture generally where parents are trying to save their kids from feeling pain
yeah.
and suffering.
Yeah.
And so, you know, flipping the script about what our job is from protecting them to actually walking the path with them when they feel the pain and the suffering.
Yeah. Have you heard the phrase, we move from being helicopter parents to lawnmower parents? So the helicopter parents is we're hovering. The lawnmower parents is we're preparing the path for the child versus the child for the path.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that, yeah, I've got to make sure it's all good and there's no mm-hmm. potential things here. And so mm-hmm. you da da da. No, that's not going to be life, you know? So
mm-mm.
once they get past that path, well, then what do they do? So it's that,
right.
Holding an image of them at their best. That's one of the things I always help mm-hmm. people do when they're dealing with someone who is really angry or upset or using or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's who they are when they're coming from the lower brain.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not who they are at their best. So
mm-hmm.
you always want to hold an image of their best. And when we get back together next time, mm-hmm. I'll show you how to reach for their best when you're talking to them.
Awesome. So this has been such a gift. And if you would, how can people get a hold of you?
Yeah. So you can Google Bill Crawford, PhD, YouTube. And that'll take you to my YouTube channel. It's got about 500 short videos on there.
Mm-hmm.
I've just got a million views.
I know. I'm so excited for you.
So
congratulations. Yeah.
So I also have a website, obviously, BillCrawfordPhD.com.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll take you to my website. So you'll see all of my presentations. You'll see my philosophy. You'll see all my products. You'll see what I do. So
mm-hmm.
those two things. And you can email me from the website. Or yeah, so it's I'm real easy to get a hold of. Just Bill Crawford, PhD, and
mm-hmm.
I'll come up all over the place. So,
mm-hmm. well, you are a true gift to all of us. I thank you so much for joining me today and for speaking to our audience. In some ways, I'm sure that this is new to them, and there will be some more new things to entertain with you in the next month or so. So, thank you, Bill.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity. Looking forward to getting back with you again and diving into that next part about how we talk to folks around that.
Great. Thank you.
My pleasure. Take care.
Okay. You too. Bye.
Addiction never affects just the addict. It affects all of us. Recovering from addiction and alcoholism is also a life-changing battle for families dealing with a loved one's addiction. Numerous programs support addicts as they reclaim their lives, while their families face their own challenges without the same guidance. You're listening to Voices in Courage with K.L. Wells, where we transform the lives of the families and loved ones of addicts and alcoholics from surviving to thriving in the midst of chaos. Tune in as we highlight vulnerable stories of families who have addicted relatives and friends and learn how they have dealt with the challenges of isolation, desperation, and shame. If you are seeking ways to live your best life, then we welcome you into this safe space. Be a part of change today with your host, K.L. Wells.